This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. We have a brilliant guest with us today. I'm going to crack on because I've got so many questions to ask this guy. It's the wonderful David Schneider, who you'll know from shows like The Day Today, Alan Partridge. He's got a film out this week, The Death of Stalin, which he co-wrote with Armando Iannucci, who's directed the movie. Very funny film. Saw it last night. He's done so many other things. Of course, he was in How Not to Live Your Life. I'm going to crack on with his first choice of two songs. This is the theme from Better Call Saul by Little Barry.
So let me know. Too many got my time.
Little Barry, the Better Call Saul theme. I'm sure it's probably got an actual name because it's a song, not a theme, but we might be able to find that out. David, hello, thank you for joining us.
It's probably called Thank God We've Earned Some Money.
Why did you pick that particular piece of music?
I'm a big Breaking Bad fan and a big Better Call Saul fan. The team behind it don't put a foot wrong with their drama, with their storytelling, with the way they shoot it, with the comedy. Everything is perfect in those shows. Apart from the theme tune, the way he cuts out the theme tune to Better Call Saul. So it was great to hear the whole song there, because he cuts at a completely bizarre moment. And every episode I go, why has he done that? It just doesn't make sense. Just be perfect, like everything else. And I'm sure there's a reason, you know, he's putting us on edge. Life doesn't resolve like, I'm not going to resolve this piece of music. But I just think, stop it! Get it right.
So you've actually picked a song that annoys you rather than something you like.
Which I think is very 2017, isn't it? Yeah, the things that I emotionally invest the most in
are things that piss me off.
Yeah. And that is, I love the show, but what's going on there?
I don't know. Probably someone else said to him, you know, you've only got like 8 seconds for a... Because have you noticed that opening credits in especially American shows are getting shorter and shorter?
Yes.
Now it's just like the title appears and a sting of music rather than a long...
But I think if you've done Breaking Bad and you've done Better Call Saul, I think nobody tells you to cut your music. You know, it's a choice he's made, and that's what keeps me up at night.
Do you like Better Call Saul as much as Breaking Bad?
It's hard to answer that because you're so invested because of Breaking Bad that if you came to Better Call Saul without having seen Breaking Bad, maybe it's not quite such a good show. But I still love it. I still think it's the characters are so great. You so care for them. So.
It's weird, isn't it? That you care for these people.
Yeah, no, I'm really... Oh, God, I know. I think it's a wonderful show. So why screw up on the music?
Look, if anyone out there is listening, or even Vince, if he's listening, can we find out what your thinking behind this was?
Yes.
Just let us know. Tweet in if you're Vince Gilligan. David, congratulations on Death of Stalin.
Thanks very much.
I saw it last night. I was very encouraged to be in a completely packed cinema.
Oh, that's nice.
I really enjoyed the movie. Is it doing well?
It is doing well. Yeah. I like the way I sort of was, you know, when everyone says, I've seen your movie, I get nervous what they're going to say. I was very encouraged. I thought, I'm not sure that's going to go on the poster.
Good effort.
Yeah, Dom Jolly tweeted, saw Death of Stalin, enjoyed it. And you just thought, well, that's it. What, you've only got 60 characters to play with now?
Can't you do a bit more?
It's gone really well. I mean, it's a funny thing because the reviews were so good that you thought, you know, I'm a pessimist and I'm always thinking things are going to go wrong. So going into this opening weekend, which is so important with movies, just thinking, are people actually going to go and see it and will they like it as much as the reviewers? And thankfully they have done, and now we're expanding, you know, more than doubling the number of cinemas we're in. It's interesting being party to this, you know, the way movies work, that there is this guillotine that comes down on Monday that, you know, if you're not selling, then your film's out.
They call it not the rollover, but the hang-on. There's some term for it, which is all about, can you extend your run? Are there bookings for the following week? All that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, which I suppose it has to be. Yeah. It's about money. The highest percentage per screen possible. You know, like you said, a lot of them sold out.
Yeah.
So we did incredibly well.
I mean, the only reason I'm saying that with some kind of, not surprise, but
you thought the film was shit.
It's because I was like, what? They're all coming to see this? It feels quite highbrow as a pitch.
Yeah.
It's actually more accessible a film than maybe the pitch is, because it feels quite historic and like maybe you need to really know about that era, that period. But it's, I imagine in the film world, we get a lot of people who make independent films here and they talk about how hard it is to get people into the cinema. And I would have thought as a pitch that was a hard film to get people in, but it just seems, maybe it's obviously the calibre of all the people involved.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's Armando and it's the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we were careful with the trailer to make it clear that, yes, it's about this historical period. But it's really funny.
There's loads of slapstick.
I think slapstick's wrong. Slapstick implies it's not rooted in truth. But there's lots of physical humour.
There's a bit of a farcical...
Yes.
Isn't
and there,
there
is, you know, that thing about, you know, history plays out first as tragedy, then as farce. We've just gone straight for the farce.
Mm-hmm.
But it's both tragic and farcical. You know, the stuff that we do in the film, a lot of the things that people say, that is just so funny. How do you come up with that? It's a ridiculous situation. And you go, no, that's exactly what happened.
Really?
To give you an example, like the opening few minutes of the film are about a conductor they're asked by Stalin. Stalin rings up this orchestra and says, can you record the concerto that you've just played? Or can I have the recording? They haven't made a recording.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to make a recording. They have to keep the people in. The conductor is so panicked that they have to make a recording for Stalin that he faints. They have to get a second conductor who then turns up in his dressing gown and conducts
who
it.
Who is bizarrely has his life saved in the meantime.
Well, he thought he was going to be rounded up because the roundup's going. Yes. Yeah. So that seems preposterous that you'd keep the audience in fact get new people in because half the audience had left, that you'd have a conductor in his dressing gown having going to record it, and your life would be at stake. But the reality is that the second conductor they got was too drunk, so they had to go out and get a third conductor.
No way.
So the reality is even more farcical than what we present in the film.
How do you know these little events? How do you research this stuff?
It was just reading lots of research, talking to people. But yeah, there's a lot of books about it now. In the 80s, I remember I was first interested in the Soviet history back in the 80s, before you were born. When
I'm actually older than I look.
Well done on the moisturising. Then you just couldn't get access to material, but now there's a lot of material there. So we looked at the memoirs of the Politburo, of their kids have written about them, of people at the time, a lot of histories. And you get these little amazing nuggets that you think, what? So Stalin's son accidentally killed the whole Air Force hockey team, which is what happened. And you think, if you made it up, you just thought, no, I can't.
Yeah.
That's not believable, but it's all actually happened.
How do you sell, or how do you describe the film in a short sort of elevator pitch, as they say, like what the story is? What are people going to see?
Yeah, well, I suppose they're going to see the manoeuvrings after Stalin's death to take over power. But we call it a comedy of terrors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a comedy. It's a comedy, but it's terrifying.
And you can so see its influences from, obviously, Armando's other work, like The Thick of It and Veep and stuff.
Yeah.
There's the group of people desperately clamouring around to try and resolve a situation.
Yeah.
People are a fan of those shows. They'll definitely love this movie as well.
Yeah.
What was the thinking? Like, where did it come from? What made you go, oh, let's do that, would make a good comedy? Did it come from Armando first? Did you and he talk about it before?
Well, there's a graphic novel that it came from. So the producers, Quad, these French producers, got a hold of a French graphic novel with Death of Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And the tone is already there. This sort of absurd, ridiculous, grotesque, scary but funny tone that we have in the movie is already there in the graphic novel. I mean, we depart from the graphic novel, especially for the second half. So the graphic novel existed, and Quad approached Armando and said, will you do it? And he said, I'm busy with Veep, but if you'll wait, then I'll up for it.
Yeah.
And very keen, because he wanted to do something about dictators.
Okay.
And this just seemed absolutely perfect. I think he was going to do a fictional dictator, but this seemed absolutely right. And then I had written a play about the Yiddish theatre under Stalin, which I can bore you with if you want, because part of my upbringing is I did a PhD, unfinished, sadly for my parents, in Yiddish at Oxford. And one thing, when I was researching that, I came across the fact that this Yiddish theatre troupe, the Moscow State Yiddish Theatre, were for a while feted across the world and innovative under Stalin, because in the 20s, everything was great for the arts, and it was only sort of later on, late 20s, where Stalin started going, the terror started coming.
Right.
I was already interested in it. Armando came to see that play, and then we started talking about doing the movie.
That's interesting, because I would have thought it would have come from you guys first, because it so suits
what
you'll do. But the fact that they brought the graphic novel to you is
what's brilliant about Quad, is that they knew the right person to go to. They saw that book and they thought, this is like the sort of Armando's obsessions.
Yeah, yeah.
And the obsessions of all of those that orbit him, such as myself. And they saw it in the graphic novel. So it was a perfect marriage.
What is it about British comedy and comedians that love doing period and historical comedy? I mean, it feels more so, unless I'm overlooking some really obvious examples, but it feels more so like a British thing, whether it's Python doing, you know, nearly all their movies were historical period set, Carry On. I mean, there's a bit of Stalin that I don't know if this was a conscious move, but I was like, that could be Sid James playing Stalin.
Wow.
You know, because he's a geezer, isn't he? Which I love, by the way. I love the sort of just throwing all the kind of accent thing out the window.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Blackadder and Horrible Histories recently. I believe they're making a movie soon. And what is it about, like, playing around with those historical moments?
History allows you to get away with stuff that maybe you couldn't get away with so easily if it was contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Trump and Brexit have done a great marketing campaign for us.
Yeah.
It was we wrote it before Brexit and Trump, and now the sort of preposterousness of what's going on in the UK and America has done the marketing campaign for us, because there's so much of the film that relates to
I was wondering about that, how much
so I think through history, and that's the thing that the Soviet tradition would do, is that under Stalin they would put on plays or films that were about history, and but really everyone knew it was about Stalin.
Yeah.
So if you did a King Lear, or you showed some monstrous dictator back in history, everyone sort of knew it was actually Pat Starnett. So I think history's a way of getting away with things.
Did you have much involvement in the production as well?
Yeah, well, in the actual filming.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was went off to film a second series of Josh mm-hmm. Widdicombe's.
Which you're directing, right?
Yeah.
We'll talk about your directing in a bit, yeah.
Thank you. So I was, in a way, I was quite lucky that I did the bulk of the work before we went on set.
Yeah.
And Ian Martin did the bulk of the work on set with Peter Fellows, so they were the other writers along with Armando. And that's sort of where the real hard work is, which is where constantly coming up with outs, as we say, with alternative lines, constantly tweaking, you know, because that's the brilliance of the way Armando works, is that you have a script, but the actors know that the writers are on hand to give them alternatives, funnier alternatives, so it's, so you're constantly working. So I would swan in every now and then and see this incredible... I mean, it's nothing like... when you've written something, a little idea, like there's a moment which isn't a particularly funny one. Well, I'll give you a particularly funny example, like the spit. There's a spit in it, which I won't say any more about. But I wrote that spit. And to see that going from an idea that you have, and you go, oh, that'd be quite funny, to see that executed.
I want to know how they did that.
There's, I don't want to give it away.
You don't want to give it away.
But to say Rupert Friend, who is brilliant in the movie, practiced in his trailer a lot to get
that
right.
So it's real?
I think it's slightly enhanced, brought out. Oh, but the trajectory is all in real time,
He didn't get a stunt double in for that, a spit double.
A spit double, yeah. He's fine. Finally, I've got some work. An expectoractor.
It's been... I don't know how to say this without, you'll feel probably old if I say this. I've been a fan of yours literally since my teens. I am older than you think I am. I was born in 1976.
Oh, right, okay.
But I was like probably 18, 19 when I first discovered things like The Day to Day and On the Hour and all that kind of... That was when I first was becoming interested in what's out there comedy-wise beyond just what's clearly in front of you on TV and stuff. And... it was such an amazing period of time for comedy. I hate that I've said this before about like sounding too nostalgic and but it really does feel to me like there hasn't been a moment like that where, I mean, it felt like it was like that for many years, but where people were almost allowed to go and do what they do really well. Everyone, like that thing of seeing the people you really like, the familiar faces popping up in other people's shows, and doing stuff that's quite bold and daring. And does it feel to you, is this just as a sort of cynical onlooker, or does it feel to you like that's
changed? No, I think you're onto something there. I think there was, we had a concept when we were doing the Friday Night Armistice, which was a show, a satirical show.
I was going to say, that was a great show that I think... in a way, it's not underrated, but like doesn't feel like it's as remembered as much as...
Don't get me started.
It's like, you know, the other, some of the other shows. You
but anyway,
know.
So on that show, we used to say, nobody said no.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd have a crazy idea, and then it would just happen.
Yeah.
You know, we want Gordon Kennedy, who's the presenter of the lottery show at the time, 30-foot Gordon Kennedy with balls coming out of his ass. No one said no. It just appeared. And I think... that at that time, like, we were so trusted, going from radio on the hour to the day-to-day, and with no real TV experience at all, we were trusted to make a show in a way that you just weren't now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember the first thing we shot on I'm Alan Partridge was the lap dancing thing. And here you have a group
of... like, strange little flashback-y things.
So Partridge lap dancing to me as Tony Hess. This, he had a group who had, you know, we'd been... our claim to fame was realism, incredibly realistic comedy. And suddenly there's Steve Coogan in leather shorts, leather hot pants. And I remember it was Pete Fincham, who's the who was the exec at the time in charge of Talkback and went on to do great things in TV, just saying, oh, right, okay. This was unusual. It was a different. It was a departure, but just trusted us. We were trusted and given money and allowed to make the shows we wanted to make. And I think that that's not so much the case now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very lucky with Josh, and that there's been. I think that the exec that we had on Josh, Steve McCrum, and everyone, there was a sense where that we were trusted there. But I think generally there's a sense where, especially in the BBC, people are looking over their shoulders so much. And not just the BBC, everyone's so nervous about commissioning the right thing. They don't give things a go. So I think that's why the 90s was such an amazing creative period. You know, so you had not just our little group, but you had the Fast Show and the Big Train.
And,
you know,
Vic and Bob.
That, yeah, Vic and Bob. Because people were allowed to just do what they wanted to do.
Because I wouldn't have been aware of things like ratings and stuff and reviews back then, because I would have... yeah. just watch stuff. I didn't like. I wasn't. Yeah, I hadn't got sucked into the horrible industry bit of it. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Back then, were you getting good numbers? Because those sort of shows now are considered like where you have to go and find some niche channel to do something weird like that. But you know, they were BBC prime time.
Yeah.
Were they?
I mean, they were BBC Two.
BBC Two.
So there wasn't that so much pressure and. The ratings, you know, you did look at the ratings, very much so, and, you know, they were okay, they were fine, which is why they did, you know, why there would be more shows commissioned. So I'm not saying that people didn't care about the ratings, but there was more a sense that, well, you'd be given another shot.
Yeah.
You know, if your first series wasn't quite there, you'd be given another shot. We were lucky that the shows that we did really well straight away, but, you know, there were other shows around us that they were given more of a chance than you would now. You know, now sometimes shows are pulled even mid-run.
That's utterly depressing, isn't
so
it?
So depressing.
Oh, my God.
I mean, there's nothing, you know, it's like I've worked on a few animations and, you know, you work for 5 years. I mean, I didn't work for five years on it. And that feeling that, you know, then it goes out and it's, you know, I mean, in a way, if it's just pulled, then that's miserable. You go to therapy forever, and at least you've got stories and anecdotes. But the worst thing is when you work so hard on something, and then, you know, it's all right.
Yeah. I can't even go to therapy for this.
Yeah, yeah, you can't say, well, I didn't think, and, you know, it was...
And it was all right.
People thought it was all right. I got 3 stars.
Yeah.
You know, that's,
Did you know at the time that you had it that good as a collective... Were you all going, God, can you believe that you're like, we're going to one day go, this was an amazing, or did you just think this is how TV works?
I think it depends on your personality. I'm glass half empty, not only half empty, but there's a cigarette butt in it and it's cracked and it's just horrible. So I would always think, well, it's going to end tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think there was a sort of a swagger in our group with certain people. That, you know, step aside, we know what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the old guard is over. And I think you do need that as the young Turks.
Especially when you're doing stuff that's quite, you know, like satire or sketch stuff. That's really is like a young man's game, isn't it? It's like everyone cares so passionately about that. And then I guess Alan Partridge was where it really went even wider, wasn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, that was... Because I actually remember watching the day-to-day, flicking through the channels in, like, 95 was it?
Or wouldn't have taken you long in those days. To
Right. And I got all the way to 4.
Right.
And then I went back again.
Right.
And I remember seeing the day to day and obviously believing it was a... And it wasn't until a few months later that someone went, have you seen this show? And
That's the joy of it. When we did Knowing Me, Knowing You on Radio 4... with Partridge and the complaints that we got. Dear BBC, I can't believe you allowed this Alan Partridge on again after he hit a child last week on air. No, people just believed it, which was really good.
That is great. It, in a way, looking back, it's kind of funny that you would believe it because it seems... But actually, I suppose in a way, I know that you're very vocal about politics and you have your own podcast, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a podcast that my social media company, That Lot, puts together with Deezer. So Deezer,
okay. How did you come up with this? You're like an entrepreneur now.
I am.
Yeah, I am.
I've got a company. So yeah.
You even looked quite proud of yourself then.
Yeah,
like, I'm a businessman.
I'm going to light up a cigar. Yeah. I don't care if there's no smoking because that's the kind of entrepreneur I am. So I've got a social media company, which is partially started to justify all the time I wasted on Twitter.
Yeah.
And the founders were me and a guy who was the first ever professional tweeter, who's a brilliant social media writer, and he's just is a genius, and a guy who's good at money. Just happened to be at a time where, you know, brands and businesses needed help with social media. So because of my background, you know, and applying the rigor of TV and film to making Facebook video or whatever, it's expanded and takes up a lot of my time.
Do you think that social media is a force of good or evil?
I suppose this is the equivalent of... Well, I confess I went to public school, but the debating of, like, should fox hunting be banned or not? This is the new thing. Is social media good or bad? It's both, really.
Yeah.
It's both. It's like, it's absolutely terrible and it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And social media, I think, is to blame to a large degree for what's happened with Trump and allowing Trump and Brexit to happen. But then again, it's to blame or it's to the credit that there's more democracy, there's more interaction and stuff. And within the comedy world, that now you don't have to just go through these narrow, get into the BBC radio and then work your way up or stand up, that you can just make your own comedy. You can make a name for yourself on Twitter or YouTube, whatever. It's great democratically, but democracy is a terrible thing sometimes, he says, having just done a film about Stalin. And, you know, so you see, really the question is not, is social media good or bad, but is democracy good or bad? We've been fire hosed with democracy, and now look at the mess we've made.
There's something, though, that democracy probably wasn't prepared for in the sort of swelling of the sort of mob force thing that happens, where things can really get blown into all sorts of ridiculous proportions.
Yeah.
And like you say, like, Trump probably wouldn't have got elected pre-Twitter, would he?
No,
or pre-Facebook.
And also that his support, whether it's Russians or not, gamed the algorithms really well.
Yeah.
And the fake news, and they played that really well.
It's still on a daily basis stuns me that he's... Not only is he the president, but that he's still... does what he does.
I know.
It's like...
What he's so good at is having 20 appalling things a day. Because if you look at, like, oh, Obama's worn a beige suit or whatever it was, big scandal.
That was the week. That was the scandal of the week.
Yeah. Or, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that Obama was devoid of scandals, drones, what have you, Benghazi, etc. But the brilliance of Trump is there's so much shit that you just don't know where to start.
It's an embarrassment of riches, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an embarrassment of turds.
Yeah.
You just...
Like, which turd do I focus on?
If we
here?
All agreed to just focus on one turd, let's just focus on Russia, which I think is obviously happening with this inquiry. Or let's focus... You know, he's so good at just creating
noise, just hot air as well, you know.
But it is terrifying because meanwhile he dismantles everything and meanwhile he... fans of flames of fascism and what have you.
Do you take as much interest in the American politics as British politics? Because I follow you on Twitter and I know you're very I don't know how to unfollow.
I know. You can mute.
Yeah.
See, then I don't notice.
Okay. But you talk about British politics, which is more important to you indirectly. Are you as fascinated by the American politics?
Yeah, I mean, we're all experts now in how Congress works and... you know,
I'm not sure I still worked it all out.
True. You know, I was being rhetorical. but I mean, you know, like 4 years ago, who could have listed half the cabinet, the American cabinet?
Oh, that's true. Now, because we get told who's been fired on a daily basis.
True, I think it's so important to follow what's going on. And, you know, particularly, I suppose, I'm the son of a refugee, a Holocaust survivor. My mum would have told me stories. She told me stories. And I see things happening that are terrifying echoes. I see even that tweet that he did about crime figures going up in the UK because of radical Islamic terrorism. Just that little drip, drip, drip of scapegoating, which is so like... And I know it's like, oh, bloody hell, comparing it to Nazis. So like what was going on in Germany in the 30s. Drip, 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 just the drip of the Jews are to blame, And that's, I see that's what he's
it's
doing
so weird,
as well.
Because of, obviously, his son-in-law, and so that makes it even murkier, because you're like, but can he be? I mean, it's like, but it is, you're absolutely
right. Yeah, I mean, you wonder how you square, there's Trump is defending people who are actually saying Jews will not replace us. How is... squaring that with his son-in-law, I don't know.
I'd love to see that conversation.
But I wonder whether the son-in-law just goes, well, you know, I'm in a good position of power.
I'll take one for the
and
team.
Trump goes, is he Jewish? I didn't know. I just forgotten.
Which one of your parents was...
My mum.
Really? She fled?
Yeah, so she was lucky. She came out in 1938 from Austria. She didn't go through the camps or anything. But the Holocaust defined her experience. She was 15 at the time.
Is she still alive?
She's not alive anymore. It was a defining, and you know, there's a sort of thing called the second generation, which is what people who are children of survivors. We have an obsession with it as well. So I'm going, there's a bit of fascism. Did I even sniff a maybe little tint of it? You know, and I'll be leaping on that. You know, so the go home vans for me were a terrible evidence of no, you can't do that. You can't ban anything. You know, that for me, the never again thing is so vital.
Yeah.
This has got a long way from the comedy.
I know,
it has.
Where are the jokes? I mean, come on.
Where are the Holocaust jokes?
Everyone can talk about a film they've got, but you can't, like, you haven't got someone that directly that you're related to who first-hand witnessed that kind of thing.
Yes.
And what age were you when she first would tell you about things that happened?
Well, I can't remember a time when I didn't know about
yeah.
it. And growing up, like in the late 60s, I was born in 63. So that's, if you think about it, that's only 20 years after the end yeah. of the Holocaust, end of the war. It was just everywhere. I mean, I've got lots to say about whether it was too dominant in my life and the lives of Jews of that generation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just so part of the fabric of growing up.
We will get back to comedy and stuff, but where do you because I'm not Jewish, I don't have the same context with this particular subject, but this thing about the Labour Party having anti-Semitic issues or something, which I don't see as clearly as, like, I've got Jewish friends who've told me, oh, you know, there is this problem, and it's like, I mean, just say no if there isn't, but is there a clear-cut way of describing what that problem is?
Yes, I mean, it's how long have you got? I mean, there is a problem with some people on the left that they can't distinguish between anti-Zionism or anti-Israel, which I think is a completely natural, oh, not natural, but it's a justifiable position, and anti-Semitism, and the two bleed together. And there's no doubt that there are people on the left, many of whom are very vociferous Corbynites, who are anti-Semitic either through ignorance or sometimes through malice.
Yeah.
I think that the anti-Semitic charge has been pushed onto Corbyn. I don't think he's anti-Semitic, but there are times where he's been a little bit ignorant about it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, just tactically, Corbyn's enemies have pushed it. But that said, I am still shocked often by, for instance, Ken Loach, when asked about Holocaust denial and whether it's right or wrong, slides straight away into Israel-Palestine rather than saying, well, of course the Holocaust happened.
Yeah.
And I think there is Ken Loach, for whom I have the most admiration. Yeah. That's why it really hurts that he did that.
Yeah.
Ken, he did that to me. That was about me.
Yeah.
And I was hurt. I think actually I'm being unfair to him because I think he has clarified it since.
Right.
But at the conference, when I saw him say that, I thought, well, I don't understand how someone with the empathy and sincerity of Ken Loach cannot just say, well, obviously it's preposterous to say the Holocaust didn't happen, but has to elide it with what's going on in Israel now.
Generally speaking, there's something so counterintuitive about the supposed left, who are meant to be all in favour of equality and liberalism and stuff, having any kind of prejudice. Like, that's why it's like, I get so confused by it. But do you feel
comedy?
Well, look, here's my relatively clever segue is, like, we're talking politics, but do you feel like in this amazing time for, I say amazing in quote unquote, for political comedy, that there's still so little in the UK?
Mm.
I mean, in the US, every night, talk show hosts and political shows like The Daily Show and what have you are discussing the politics every night.
Yeah.
And yet here we've still got Have I Got News For You, mm-hmm. which isn't like a heavy political show. It just sort of mocks the sort of the headlines.
Yeah, but there's still some good points.
Absolutely. Yeah. I still like the show, but that's kind of, there's Mock the Week, but again, that's not really a political.
Well, we have The Last Leg.
The Last Leg,
and
which
I think that, so The Last Leg is a weekly show that I think is very effective, and also is very effective on social media, not just because we do the Channel 4 mm-hmm. social media. So I think there is The Last Leg, and there is also social media.
Yeah.
But we don't have the resources to do a daily show, I don't think.
Or even a couple of other weekly shows.
Yeah.
You know, like, you guys were doing the Friday and it was the Saturday
first.
You know, where are the people doing, especially people that's where they've come from as well, from doing political comedy? It's like, as far as I know, Josh wasn't a political comedian before, was he?
No,
but they're giving
it
to people who can obviously translate to a wider audience.
Yeah.
But it still feels to me like we're missing a beat considering the amount that's going on in the world.
Yes, it feels, I mean, the MASH report was good, I thought.
That
could take off. But because we can only do it apart from The Last Leg, which is on a lot of the year, which is why I think it's an exception to the rule, because we do it in 6-week chunks. We basically have a series of six. There's not that momentum to build up. I mean, we did that with the day-to-day as well. You know, the armistice as well was six, maybe eight we did. You know, so you need momentum and you need resources. And also you need a channel that will take risks. I think that's the big thing, that will take political risks as well. Channel 4 and BBC do their best, but, you know, it's a different world. That's why I think you have to look to social media. That's where there's so much satire. So if you got someone to collect all the satire that there was in the 90s and measured it on a huge scale with all the satire that there is now, actually there's much more satire now. It's just not centralised on TV.
Right, yeah. Slightly out of the blue question.
Mm.
In the 90s,
yeah,
were you known more for Give Me a Second Series or for Mission Impossible?
All right. I don't know why you narrow it down to the 90s rather than that. Yeah.
Is that still what your most second series? I mean, the fact that Monkey Tennis is now a part of the lexicon is kind of remarkable,
isn't
it?
Yeah. That's an amazing feeling to have been something where that people quote all the time. Yeah,
I bet it is, especially 20 years later.
Yeah.
20 years later and people are still saying that. When I was 20... people quoting stuff from like the 60s or me feeling like, why are people still quoting their history?
Well, I think about how I can quote Monty Python.
Yeah.
To think that we might be, I'm not saying we're, you know, as good as Monty Python, but that, you know, that there's, to some people, that's their formative
100%,
thing, you know.
Yeah.
It's, luckily, it's something that I'm very proud of, you know, like lots of people that things are quoted that they're not proud of.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Smell My Cheese is probably what I'm shouted at
really?
Most.
Really? Okay, yeah.
And Give Me a Second Series. And then, sort of Mission Impossible, people have tended to forget, and then I crop up now. But yeah, but it was a wonderful experience. I mean, being on a huge, huge movie.
Yeah. And how did you get that role?
Just through a casting, I think. They might have seen me in Day to Day or something. I don't know, but just through a casting.
Yeah.
And
Was it CGI or was Tom really feet from your face?
Yeah, so Tom. So I was on set for 6 weeks
For that sequence.
Yeah, because it's CGI. We were on in Pinewood and they had the front of a train or the end of a train.
I mean, it's like
a huge blue screen
13-minute sequence.
Yeah, that took 6 weeks. And so Tom was or TC as we called him.
Yeah,
was 2 feet away from me, separated by some perspex, which I guess is contractual.
But wherever he goes.
Yeah, that's right, between him and the actors. But I remember the first time he crawled onto the perspex, and so I thought, oh, it's Tom Cruise talking. So, and I remember going, because I was in my sort of conductor's outfit, I went, oh, fares please, which is like the wrongest thing you can say to someone who, A, isn't British, B, hasn't lived in Britain in the 1950s, or been on a bus, or, you just get that rush of blood and go, oh. But, yeah.
It was a good gag, by the way, but it just,
the wrong audience. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah.
He was very, very nice guy. And then, that's so exciting for me, because I remember on the premiere, so you get a limo. It's the first time I'd got a limo. And, in fact, it's probably the only time I've got a limo where they say, I will drive you wherever you want for 24 hours. That's what you do, or for 12 hours. So they pick you up at 6.
And you're like, where haven't I been in London before?
Well, not just London. You know, I said to him, so you drive me to Brighton? Absolutely, I am yours till whatever it was, like
amazing.
12 o'clock next morning. Yeah. So I wasn't very imaginative. Just said, I'll go to the premiere, please. but I was, I'd never done anything on that scale before.
Yeah.
And I also didn't know whether my little bit would be in it. Because it was a little, the fainting at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, that I faint at the end of the movie.
You've ruined the entire franchise for some people.
Well,
they can't watch any of the sequels now, they know that.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah, because it is, that's the
so real, integral
it's
to
the plot twist. Yeah. But there's no jokes in the movie. There's nothing funny in the movie. And my faint is, I think, quite funny.
Yeah.
But when it came out, so a big Empire of Leicester Square, where a big cinema came out, it was in there, it got a laugh, and I just stood up going and went, yes! I mean, arms out, just so excited. and then thought, I've just shown the bloke even that. Just and sat down again, but I just
Man, someone else in the front row who'd just seen that scene and then looked around and you're the guy.
I mean, any nutcase standing up in the theatre going yes.
Yeah.
I mean, but
maybe they thought it was like some sort of interactive theatre experience, the Rocky Horror, where they get up and sing along were just performing.
Why don't people do that to my Mission Impossible? Everyone should faint at that time. Yeah. Oh, nice idea.
There'd be a little ball at the bottom going along with the words and then faint.
Faint, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was so exciting. Still, I suppose, is it the biggest movie? It must have been the biggest movie I've done, so early in my career.
Yeah. We worked together. You were kind enough to do a bit in my show, which I was very grateful for. Yeah. And I think I mentioned this to you on set, but you were in a show that I feel like just kind of was so underappreciated at the time, which was the Peter Principle. Now, in a weird sort of way, I think it was out of fashion because it was quite a broad studio audience sitcom, and at the time, much more like, I don't know, it's slightly more left field or sophisticated stuff was.
Yes.
But it was such a funny, simple show. It was Jim Broadbent as the lead character, as the it was a bank
set in a bank, as a character who's promoted above his station.
Yeah,
which now it would be a president. But
and
yeah,
I can't remember how many seasons. Was it just one season?
Two seasons.
And me and a friend of mine who we were like, you know, we've known each other since we were 14. We were such big fans of the show. It was like, it just seemed like, who else is seeing this?
It was a great cast because Jim Broadbent, funny man.
Yeah.
Just being really funny.
When he does that sort of thing, he's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, now he does, you know, beautiful, moving plays.
Nuanced.
Poets and whatever. But he's so good at comedy. I mean, I remember to this day him doing this scene where he had to throw up, you know, so, you know, you didn't see it, but you heard it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it was hilarious. Because it was, he not only did the throw up, he did the a lot of the sort of, the after throw, the you know, a lot, and it was beautifully done.
Yeah.
Such a fun, Claire Skinner was in it, who went on to being outnumbered and stuff. So, yeah, it was really.
The couple of my favourite performances of Jim Broadbent was, he was so good in his recurring role in Only Fools and Horses.
Yes.
As the slimy cop who is sort of nemesis. But also, have you...
he gets a lot, you know, he's won Oscars, I think. But he's always going to be, you know, to the British public, he'll always be, what's his name, Slater?
But also, have you seen Bullets Over Broadway, the Woody Allen film?
Yeah.
He is hilarious in that film. Yeah. It's one of the, this is probably, you're not allowed to laugh about this now, unfortunately, or probably correctly, but it's one of the funniest putting on weight jokes that's ever been, because he's like on a diet, but over the course of the film, you see them slowly getting bigger and sneaking off and eating chicken.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But no, he's just phenomenal,
he's a
in that.
Funny man.
Well, I wonder,
it's nice that you like that.
Is it available anywhere?
I don't know. It must be somewhere. Yeah, written by Mark Burton, who's a Hollywood writer now, and John O'Farrell, who writes, you know, sort of stood for Labour. But he's got, and John's got a really funny book out about being a Labour supporter over the last.
Okay.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I think the Peter Principle would probably do better now in this age of like Miranda's and Mrs. Brown Boys.
Yeah.
Not, it was probably more smarter than that, but just the fact that it had a lot of farce and
a lot of well-structured mainstream comedy with lots of jokes. Yeah.
There was that whole episode where he's stuck in the atrium between the exterior doors and interior doors. Do you remember that? Yeah, like proper farce.
Yeah.
How did you get into comedy? Did you ever do live stuff?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did my national service on the circuit. Did my 3 years.
The Edinburgh thing.
You did that Edinburgh thing where you think, yeah, this is my year. Actually, there's rumours I'm going to be shortlisted to the Perrier. Oh yeah, yeah. Have you had that?
I had that even when I knew I wasn't eligible anymore. I was still like, they're going to bend the rules this year just to allow me to. It's awful.
Because you go up going, I'm experienced now. I know what it's like.
I'm just going to enjoy the show.
Exactly. If I get better, that's what counts. I don't care if three people come. As if I get better.
Yeah.
And then you're going, well, there's no one in the show.
And why is that person doing so well?
The bitterness.
Why? I'm so glad that even back. Well, I'm not glad. I wish that there was a time where it didn't do this to people, but I'm glad to know that it's been like that for everyone. It just makes me feel less self-absorbed.
Yeah, no, it is the city of shattered dreams.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've done all that. But yeah.
And
so,
is that how you met everyone, or did you meet people university?
Helpfully for the rumours that there's an Oxbridge Mafia, I met Armando at Oxford.
Yeah.
And we used to have a sort of loose sort of double act where we do our own thing and then come together for a few sketches ourselves.
Really?
So there was a really lovely moment, actually, because Arm and I, we're both square. We're both sort of prematurely middle-aged in a way. And, well, we are middle-aged now, but we were at university. And we would go and we'd do all this gig at a ball or some event. And then we, it would go really well. And then everyone would go and get drunk. And we'd just cycle back to one of our rooms to have coffee and a hobnob or whatever.
Coffee and, that late, though, that's quite rock and roll.
Actually, it's probably a peppermint tea.
Yeah, it's a bit beatnik.
But then cut to 33 years later, I don't know how many years later, it must be at least 33. The premiere, the world premiere in Toronto of his movie, which I co-wrote, wonderful success. Everyone's he's fated. Yeah. There's this amazing party where there's acrobats and Russian this and a vodka fridge you can walk into, all this and all the sort of, the film world is there. It's all wonderful. And Arm and I, we're so old now, we can't, if there's lots of people talking in a room, we can't really hear. So we just left. We just left and went and got an ice cream. And it was exactly the same.
Celebration for your big...
There's no point. We couldn't hear anyone speak. We're too deaf. We're too old. and so it was this amazing, and Arm pointed it out that, it was like cycling back to our rooms. We just left the sort of buzz and just went and had a chat over an ice cream.
I like that there's still that, there's a continuity there.
Yeah, I know, it was really nice. And that's the great thing about Armando, that he's still Jenny from the block. It hasn't gone to his head. And I think that's why his work is so good.
I've always thought of him as a sort of Jennifer Lopez of British comedy.
Always, you never see them in the same room.
That's true. That is true. Was it an emotional experience? Were you both like, wow, look where we've...
Yeah, I think there was, we didn't cry and hug. No. But because we're
alpha male, aren't we?
Alpha male, yeah. No, but I think we did, I'll mention it. And it was just a really nice thing that you do have those moments in life where you look back and you very much remember where you were 20, 30 years ago, if you've lived that long. And then, you can see, it was a really nostalgic moment. And sort of going... That's all right, isn't it? Yeah, so it's really nice.
Is the working relationship still the same? Does it still feel...
Yeah, that was the amazing thing about that. We still, when we were writing it, we'd still get up in a room and act out and make each other laugh. Well, he certainly made me laugh. I hope I made him laugh, it was like... I mean, I think that's the great thing about working with Armando, because he's, we're always... anyone is funnier when they're with their mates, aren't they?
Yeah.
So to work with your mates and feel relaxed and just feel that you can be as funny as you want try things is great. Yeah.
And so you mentioned this before, but you're now directing.
Mm.
How long have you been doing? You direct the sitcom Josh with Josh Widdicombe. How long is that? The first TV show you've...
No, I suppose I started directing on the Armando Iannucci shows, the Channel 4
really?
Shows.
Do you know what? That is one of my favourite sketch broken comedy things ever. Yeah. It was such an amazing show.
I mean, talk about underrated.
Oh my God.
That is some great stuff in there.
And I did work with Armando once on a very short lived political show on... I just did a little bit in it. And I said to him, I love that show. Yeah. He said it was something to do with 9/11 happened, and the show was on the night after, and everyone was obviously just watching the news 24/7, and it just sort of got a bit lost or something.
Yeah.
But it was so clever and so
loads of great stuff in that.
Yeah.
So I sort of co-directed some of that, especially when the bits that he's in, and got a bit of a taste for it there, and then sort of said, no, I'm an actor, I want to be an actor. And it took me a long, long time to realise that, and it's only the last 2 or 3 years, really, thanks to directing Josh and directing adverts and a lot of the videos that I do for my social media company, that I thought, actually, what I love and what I feel happiest and more confident with is directing and writing. Mm-hmm. And I've let go of being an actor, and I've let go of all that thing we were talking about in Edinburgh, and how dare, God, but this person got 4 stars, I only got 3 stars. All that's gone now. I've let go of it.
I'm going through that. So after we've recorded, I might need some counselling.
In the Zen Club.
About 5 years.
It's not easy. And there's still that shallow part of me that thinks, let me on the telly, as Partridge would say. But I'm so much happier. Yeah. So do let go. Try and let go of that.
Yeah,
if you want. I mean, so where are you at now, then?
I just... I basically got so frustrated with the relationship with the business in terms of being like, you're just such a victim to other people's decisions. Yeah. And even having like a period of like heat and then having lots of offers and then going to like total like tumbleweed and going, how is this going to be like this? You like, you just got no control of when you're going to be in vogue or whether people like you or do like you. And obviously when you do stuff, you'll know this, when you do stuff and people love it, it's, you know, it's an amazing feeling. Being recognised and someone say, oh, that, because you can see in their face that you've made them laugh at some point in their life. And you get a bit, it can be quite addictive, that feeling. And then I just decided not to focus on it, like, a bit like you, to write, direct, do things like this, and I do stand-up. And genuinely, the minute I made that decision, I felt so much better. And then I started getting bizarrely offers for acting work, and I did a few things last year. And I was like, I'm not even sure if I actually enjoy standing on a mark all day and being twisted slightly to my left.
Do
you know what I mean? And I'm like, I don't know. So I haven't ruled it out completely. Yeah. If a good thing comes along and I really want to do it, or if I wrote something that I thought only I could play it, then maybe I'd do it. But at the moment, it's the writing, it's the directing, it's doing stuff like this.
I mean, when you're directing, you're being creative all day.
Yeah.
Whereas an actor, there's a lot of hanging around in your trailer, and then and personally, I always thought, I mean, even doing the smell my cheese scene after it, I thought, oh, that was rubbish. I don't think I was any good in it.
Oh,
you know,
God.
You just think, you know, I was always down on myself. Whereas I'm probably more insufferable as a director, where I was like, no, I know what's right. I know
Well, also, you haven't got the time to overthink things. You just have to make to be instinctive, don't you? And I like that about that as well. Listen, I could talk to you for hours, but we only have one.
Good.
I'm afraid.
Okay.
So we're going to before you go, I want you to tell us what you've picked as a guilty pleasure. I mean, I actually know, but for the listeners, tell me what you've picked.
Well, it's not the guiltiest pleasure, but it's First Dates. I do like watching First Dates.
What was weird is when you emailed me that, I'd been watching, I think I watched two back to back the night before.
Right, okay.
My girlfriend loves it, and I pretend I'm a bit above it, but actually can't get enough of it.
No.
Why do you love it so much?
Well, I fast forward through a lot of it because I'm not really interested in the subtext of the waiters and stuff. I want the people.
Yeah.
And what is great about, I used to be obsessed with Big Brother. I used to
really
in this Channel 4 days. I used to because it's, and my justification was because it's a very immoral program in many ways. sort of gladiatorial. Are you entertained?
Yeah.
But it's you see people at their most people-y. And I think that's the thing about First Dates, is that this everyone has a story. It reminds you how everyone has a story. You want them. You're rooting for them. There's drama there because you're rooting for them. And also, it's a reminder to yourself not to be a prejudiced tosser.
Yeah.
Because so often I go, there's someone comes on, oh, I have a bit of this, and I go, God. And I wheel in the snobbery.
Yeah.
And then you see that they've been through cancer, or they've helped their mum, or they had a terrible, some terrible thing. And you see that they're a decent, wonderful human being. Some of them aren't decent ones. But I think it's unlike some of the reality shows that thrive on people being shits.
Mm-hmm.
This is one where it teaches us that everyone has got a bit of good in them. And then 2017, Dan, that's what we need.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
And you're running on this particular.
I certainly need to be reminded that some people are good. And there's
I know. Yeah. I think the prejudice thing is really true, and I'm terrible for that. Like, just, you know, thinking I've sussed someone out in a millisecond, you know, and then being surprised. My other, because I agree with you on that, that's partly why I like things like that, but that as well. But it's also, when you write and you create stuff, it's so hard to watch things without the critical brain going. And because it's so far removed from what I do for a living, it's like, I guess, for some people watching sport or something, it's just like, I don't know how they make this show. I'm just going to go with it.
And,
you know, it seems. And real people rather than actors. And,
I do wonder whether Fred is actually from Hull, the French head waiter, whether he's actually But, you know, I've really got a great career with this French accent stuff. Actually, I know he's not, because we do some stuff. We do the Channel 4 stuff. And he's a
you're
nice
perpetuating
guy,
but, a terrible French. Myth there.
Yeah, Fred from Hull.
So your second of... Well, actually, you picked three songs, but we don't have time for all three of them. The one we're not going to play is from Lord of the Rings, so you could tell us a little bit why you wanted to pick that. But also, then I'll describe the song that we're going to play out on. But what is it about Lord of the Rings that you... the music that you love so much?
Well, it's Lord of the Rings that I love. I was a real Lord of the Rings nerd in...
From the book.
Yeah. Let's discuss the Silmarillion. You know, like, I know, I don't think elves would not do that. In the Elvish, in the original Elvish, the word is Karara. So that sort of nerdy stuff. And so that's what I was like instead of having girlfriends as a teenager. and then the films came out, and the tension with, when you love something as much as I loved Lord of the Rings, then, you know, the tension is whether the films will be any good. And just that first scene of the first film was so good. And then I remember going to see the first screening with all the nerds queuing up, and you could feel the nerdy relief.
Yeah.
But I also auditioned for it. I auditioned for Gollum.
And yet you still have so much love for it.
So that goes to show. Yeah. I obviously didn't get it. And I like to say that, no, I would have been a fantastic Gollum, but I scared the bejesus out of them with how obsessive I was about the movie.
You would have thought that would stand you in good stead, wouldn't you?
But I think I was so mad.
They could see
in the eyes that I would be trouble, and I would be going up to Peter Jackson saying, I don't think you can do this, because if you look in book two, he actually...
Page 43, I think you'll find.
So
it has a... And then this piece of music we are going to play out, this is from the movie Pulp Fiction, which everyone will recognise. This has become such a familiar piece of music. Is it this piece of music, or is it the film?
It's really the piece of music that, you know, I like. I used to, when I was at Oxford, I was a punkabilly.
went from a Lord of the Rings geek to a punkabilly.
I didn't know who I was. I've only just found out in the last year or so. But this was the sort of music that I really liked then.
Did you know this piece of music before the film?
But the film itself was a real, like, you know, I mean, there's nothing original to say. It broke the mold so much in what you can do with filmmaking.
It was exciting, wasn't it?
And I think, like, if you look at Death of Stalin is a lot of it. Is the Royale with Cheese thing.
Yeah.
Whether what's great about the Royale with Cheese scene is like, oh my God, gangsters talking normally like normal people. And what we've done in Death of Stalin is we've shown that the Politburo are just normal people.
Yeah.
I mean, horrible people.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're just normal people who talk and behave as normal people would. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of frightening thing. The subtitle of Death of Stalin should be Soviet Royale with Cheese.
Do you know what that is in Russian?
I don't know. Oh. I know.
Come on, that would have been the best way to end.
I'm not going
to.
I've offended Russia enough without doing some bad Russian.
I was going to ask: did you shoot in Russia?
I think there was
some of the exteriors.
Well, we shot quite a bit in Ukraine.
Okay,
not quite a bit. Mostly was here, so you might notice some of the. Oh, that's the Mansion House, and that's Ali Pally.
Yeah.
But there was some shooting. I think there was a week or so in Ukraine, and I think there might have been a day in Moscow, but I'm not sure.
I thought, did they get permission, and would Putin have been okay with this?
I mean, if there is anyone from Russia listening, I had nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah, okay.
But
don't eat at Itsu anytime soon. David, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. Good luck with the rest of the run of The Death of Stalin. I love the film.
Thank you.
Big fan of your work. And I just hope that you keep making great stuff. This is Dick Dale and his Deltones, not the Deltones. Is that what it says?
As opposed to the other person's Deltones. Yeah.
We've all got a Deltone, mate. And this, as everyone will know, is from Pulp Fiction.